This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My name is Alan Scott. This is the place where government actions come face-to-face with business decisions. Online at www.bgov.com. And of course on the air right here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, where this week we've got a round table of guests, as you can see before me, or imagine you can see them before me, I guess I should say, from many areas of Bloomberg, including Bloomberg Government and Bloomberg Industries. For starters, we've got Melissa Avstray from Bloomberg Industries, and of course, Dr. Neela Richardson from Bloomberg Government, and Dr. Christopher Payne as well from Bloomberg Government. Roundtable discussion, as I mentioned a moment ago. Feel free to chime in whenever necessary. We're going to start off with the big news of the week, and that's a budget deal. Did I just hear budget deal? Did someone say budget deal? Melissa?
Yes.
What are we talking about here? Is this a good thing, a bad thing? Are Republicans happy, sad, indifferent? What's going on?
Well, yes, you did hear a budget deal.
Okay.
Which hopefully...
Did you say budget deal?
I did say budget deal.
Just checking. Just wanted to make sure.
Which hopefully will allow you to never hear the two words shutdown or sequestration again.
At least for the next few years.
Exactly.
Apparently. Okay.
Exactly. So no one's thrilled. No one's disappointed. It's a very good deal that raises spending for next year in order for Congress to avoid cuts to the Pentagon's budget and to discretionary spending, which is essentially what everyone in the room wanted. You know, avoiding sequestration was the top priority. The Republicans didn't get reforms to Social Security and Medicare, the entitlement programs that they were pushing. The Democrats didn't get revenue increases through reforming the corporate tax code, for example. The Democrats also did not get provisions to extend unemployment.
There's some other underlying areas as well that have to do with government employees and their pensions.
Yes. So they needed to, so they're going to spend more money next year than the law allowed. So they had to raise the budget caps. And in order to do that, they had to come up with some way to pay for that. And as I was saying, the Republicans were pretty firm on not raising taxes.
Mm-hmm.
So what they did was they made some changes to pensions, making federal employees pay more for their retirement. They changed some of the premiums that companies have to pay to the government that guarantees their pensions. And they also are increasing the fees that airline passengers pay into a big pot that funds security.
Okay, that's totally random, if you ask me.
Well,
economically speaking, and I turn to the economists in the room, is that a fair thing to do, raise the amount of money users are to contribute to their own pension plans for the government to reinvest?
Fairness went out the window a long time ago. This is another deal that just kicks the can down the road. It does nothing for deficit reduction, does nothing to help the millions of Americans that are long-term unemployed because they decided not to extend the employment benefits. But it does keep the government remedying, which I thought was an automatic thing, but apparently you need a big deal to do that nowadays. So.
I mean, I'm probably not quite as harsh as Neela on that. I mean, firstly, if you were going to get, they had to commit to the same spending level. So as Melissa said, if you spend a bit more there, then you have to cut a bit more there. And obviously, those were three areas in the whole vast apparatus of federal government that both sides could agree on. And unfortunate for those three sets of consumers or workers or employees that have to pay for it, but at least they could find an agreement. So let's take that as good news that it
hasn't been voted on yet, though.
This is true, but you have to think after the debacle of the whole previous shutdown debate that it will be. I mean, the other thing is that the fiscal situation in this country is not as bad as once it was. Quite a lot has been done. We've had additional revenue. We've had quite a lot of spending cuts as well to make things better. But I mean, the key thing, and this is what I mean, obviously there is still, the economy is still suffering from the financial crisis, a lot of long-term unemployment. Okay, fine. Well, not fine, that's bad, but you know, and there's nothing about that. But in terms of entitlements, we actually have fairly stable debt levels now. That's what I'm trying to get to. We've pretty stable debt levels for the next 10 years. They're around in the early 70s, 70%. That is actually perfectly acceptable for a modern developed country like the US that has still good, decent growth rates, unlike Europe. It's fine. The big question about entitlement, that's where the can has been kicked down the road, obviously, because there's some demographic issues hitting the 2020s, 2030s. But it's not, you know, I think we can... Bond markets, bond investors should be pretty happy with where we are at the moment. Neela's looking at me as if she's about to disagree. So I'll hand over to her.
I think Chris is absolutely right that in the next 10 years, which is much longer than anyone in Washington can pay attention to, the budget situation looks pretty good, and then it falls off a cliff. And the
another cliff,
because things get really bad, disastrous, because we still haven't been able to solve this problem of how to have entitlements, the kind that we want, and not raise taxes. Well, the problem is unsolvable, and this deal does nothing to even approach solving it. Mm-hmm. It does keep the budget, the government open, which is what Melissa told us is a big win.
So ultimately, this Congress, and it's no secret, is the worst Congress in recorded history. They cannot make a decision to save their lives. They've passed fewer bills than any other Congress ever. This is something that okay, let's say that...
It's better than the Congress of the late 1850s, I'd wager.
Okay.
So is my mobile phone, but that's not really saying much, right?
Okay, so I guess what I'm getting at here is it took this Congress a long time to come up with this deal that not both sides are happy with. How does this impact the ability for the government, for the United States, to be able to get credit from other organizations for things? Do people look at this long term now saying, oh my gosh, these Americans, they can't get it right?
Listen. I mean, bond prices, but the yields that investors pay, or the yields that government pay, or the interest that government pays on people's bond holdings is still very low, and the US Treasury is still the safe reserve asset. The US dollar is still the reserve currency. US Treasuries are still the, quotes, risk-free asset that investors go to and hold.
I like the quote.
Well, you know, nothing is risk-free, but it's because it seems rather strange to talk about risk-free right. with debt ceilings and the rest of it. At some point in the future, if nothing has happened, I mean, it's not really a cliff we go off in the early 2020s, but I think it's 15 years where things get progressively worse. So even during that time, you know, it's better to deal with things now, of course, because there's going to be all kinds of vested interests in the early 2020s don't want to be the ones that suddenly cut like this. This is why you have to do entitlement stuff a long way in advance, right? But I think investors globally will continue to be happy seeing the US dollar as a risk-free asset. The things that really spooked investors were the stupid self-inflicted damage, shutdown and debt ceiling. That's the really dumb stuff. This is not what everyone would perfect, but it is a deal.
And it does kind of makes things a little hopeful that come February, when Congress is going to need to address the whole debt ceiling issue again, they can say, well, they were able to come together, they reached an agreement that wasn't great for either sides, but worked. We mm-hmm. avoided the shutdown, we avoided sequestration, so here we are in February, we're addressing the debt ceiling again, and hopefully Congress won't give the investors the ride that they
crisis,
had.
Then, like, I'm out of here.
one last chip in there, Neela. Go ahead.
I think it's just the power of low expectations. This is something that was supposed to be done. It's supposed to be done every year, and yet this is what it took to get, you know, a deal. And I find it sad.
Yeah, yeah. But right before they go off on a break, they decide to possibly make a deal. We'll see what happens. Let's shift topics here. Neela, you have jumped in with both feet into this Volcker rule. In fact, you penned something recently. Volcker rules bite depends on enforcement. Let's talk about this, because this is the month that this is supposed to happen. Is it going to happen, and why is it good, bad? And I know Chris is chomping at the bit to chime in as well.
Maybe. Depends on what Neela says.
Depends on what Neela says. Go
I
ahead.
Get to go first.
Go ahead.
First mover advantage. Well, this rule is a lot more lenient in some places than was expected, and a lot stricter in other places. So it allows banks to do their primary functions when it comes to client interfacing, in terms of market making, underwriting. It gives a lot of latitude, but it's conditional latitude. Banks can continue to make markets in different assets by holding inventories as long as they don't hold too much.
Right.
Now, the question is that every compliance office in a bank that does this kind of market-making activity is going to ask is, how much is too much? And the regulations are very explicit about that. Where it's tough is when it comes to hedging. What the regulators have tried to do is to make sure that every trade is linked to a specific and identifiable risk. What that means practically is that we'll no longer see this kind of JP Morgan portfolio hedging that led to this enormous morphed whale trade that cost that company about $6 billion.
Right.
That's disallowed under the Volcker rule. It ends that kind of speculative trading, but it also ends the kind of trading that's a hedging that's done across asset classes. Now, how banks are able to conform their hedging practices to a very tailored view of what hedging is a question that they'll have to answer over the next year. They'll have to get into compliance July of 2015. I can feel Chris breathing over my shoulder I wanted to give you the facts
This up, by the way. You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, where my guests are Melissa Avstray, Drs. Neela Richardson, and Christopher Payne. Neela just so eloquently wrapped up the Volcker rule, and I believe Dr. Christopher Payne is now here with his rebuttal.
It's not a rebuttal. I mean, I think it's the rule has come out quite, I think, at least it's a rule that's reasonably short, and they're very hard to write in this day and age. The interesting thing is, a question for Neela.
Sure.
Is the interesting thing for me is to what extent are we going to come back to this situation where you've got very, very, very highly paid traders with very, very, very highly paid lawyers and very highly paid advocates on their side, just essentially capturing, you know, telling regulators, a regulator comes in and says, well, you know, is trying to determine, we've got all these different, there's so many traders, market makers working at these banks, so many of them, and the resources the regulator has are so tiny in comparison. To what extent can they just use a technical term, bamboozle? Yet again, will regulators be bamboozled, and will actually a lot of the sort of style of portfolio hedging that led to the London Well just continue, because ultimately the regulators aren't in a position to really say, no, we disagree, because they're outgunned, massively outgunned in resources. I would say there's many other aspects of this that are very clear. No, you can't have prop trading. Done. No, your market maker can't run a book on the side, which is exactly what they used to do, because I used to work at one of these banks when the market makers ran a book on the side. So there's plenty of stuff there that stop. But this kind of opaque area, is there still an area for this kind of regulatory capture?
Well, that's the issue. That's why enforcement is so crucial, and we have agencies that are underfunded even in the current budget agreement, CFTC, Commodity Futures Trading Commission being one of them. No, to answer your question, right now regulators don't have the resources to go into these banks and say this is prop trading and this is hedging or this is market making. In fact, JP Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon said you need a lawyer and a psychiatrist to figure out whether the typical trade is a prop trade or actually a hedge or market making. And so in absence of those two things, you really won't know. Regulators will be dependent on metrics in a way never before to determine this, and even then it'll be guesswork. So what does that mean practically? It means that lawyers win, which they usually do.
Well, of course,
lawyers
win
because the vaguer the rule, the more likely it is that an adverse compliance lawyer, a compliance officer, will say, no, just don't do that trade.
Right.
We don't want to get in trouble. We don't want to run afoul of the law. Just don't do it. So the lawyers in these banks themselves will be creating the bright lines, not the regulators. Some will be willing to push the envelope a little bit more. Some will be very risk averse and create very strict standards.
You're a lawyer and you work for one of the big banks, and can you see them? Can you can you really see them having that kind of control over risk management? And I mean, bless the lawyers, right? Bless the lawyers. But I they don't actually understand. In fact, I would go as far to say is that I've never met a lawyer who really understands this kind of part of investment banking activity.
So the banks, the traders themselves, can run afoul of their own
exactly
compliance
what I would,
compartments,
I'd,
and that's going to be an issue.
Absolutely.
And I think Chris actually just made a confession moments ago that he was there when they were running books on the side.
I wasn't doing it.
He wasn't doing it, though.
In those days, it was fine.
In those days, it was okay. Right, of course, of course. So Volcker rule coming, the rule that would ban all proprietary trading and federally insured financial institutions, ending the banking practice of using clients' funds to make speculative bets on asset prices. Good or bad? I'm going to go around the table. Oh. Good or bad thing? Melissa.
Well, as the one here without the doctor, I'm not sure if my opinion matters at all. I'll say good.
Good. Neela.
To the extent that there's now certainty, there's something to react to and something to organize around, probably good. We've made some progress. We can take a step forward. But I think that the rule was always overkill.
Right.
They backed off from a lot of the things that could kill trading and liquidity in these markets. Mm-hmm. And so the key question is, will banks be safer mm-hmm. with these hedging restrictions than they were before?
Well, it's a kind of yes and no. I mean, it's a hedged response, obviously. Mm-hmm. And I think, yes, to some, this is a rule, and it's probably a good rule, but there may have been better ways of doing things. There may have been in the UK, for instance, we had the Vickers rule, Vickers Commission, that said, investment banks, you do what you like. You be investment banks. You create the liquidity. You trade. But we'll also protect our commercial banks within those larger organizations by ring-fencing them. Not Glass-Steagall, not complete separation, but ring-fencing. And that way you allow banks to be banks while protecting those within them that deserve protecting. So that may have been another way forward. The problem with a lot of this sort of activity is if you regulate one part, then it will just go elsewhere, and some of those risks might spread to the other part of the financial industry. There may have been another approach, but if you simple yes and no, yes.
Yes. All right. Well, maybe they can beef up the regulation moving forward to not only protect, not only make Volcker Rule better, but to help the Redskins as well. But I don't see that happening.
The connection between Volcker and the Redskins is something I'm going to have to think about.
You're right. I don't even think Volcker could help them.
They were both passed on a snowy day. I don't know.
Moving on, you're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, where my guests are Melissa Avestre, Dr. Neela Richardson, and of course Dr. Christopher Payne from Bloomberg Industries and Bloomberg Government, respectively. Bitcoin. This is something that I just can't wrap my head around. I mean, I understand it. Virtual money.
Or put your finger on it.
Yeah, or put, thank you, Melissa. Or put your finger on it. If virtual currencies become widely used, regulators are bound to revisit the issue of consumer protection. I get it. And those are the words of Dr. Christopher Payne. Chris, talk to us about Bitcoin. What's going on here? Why is this so popular?
If you think about just the simple value of transactions in the U.S., let's say there were $16 trillion. I think that's about right. The expenditure in the U.S. was $16 trillion. And that doesn't take account of the probably another $200 trillion of just transactions, right? My point is Bitcoin transactions over the 12 months leading up to the end of October were about $8 billion. So we are talking minuscule. I mean, for a start, it's tiny, 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 tiny. I mean, and that's the first thing. So this is a story in the media, and it's really a story about the future. But there's two things going on here. That there's getting rid of, there's people bypassing bank fees that we're all fed up of paying, transferring our own money. And then there's the big issue about bypassing governments that control how people use their money in a significant way by having controls on their capital, on movement of money in and out of the country. So there's some very interesting aspects to this. But it hasn't particularly paid. It's not a major currency in this country by a long
right.
way. And at the moment, regulators are treating it as such. And back to your original question, which is that regulators are treating it as they should treat it, which is an experiment that shouldn't be cut off at its very beginning.
Okay.
If it starts to be majorly used by consumers for storing value, if you like quasi-Bitcoin banks, if it starts to be used as a major means of transaction, of paying for transactions, then at that point they're going to need to be consumer protections like like banks,
sure.
like consumers protected sure. because banks are regulated and what they can do with your deposits in the same way we're going to have that. But at the moment, it's just really focusing on money laundering issues, criminal networks, that kind of thing, and focusing on those institutions that do some, you know, that govern these, that manage transactions
right.
and that allow you to buy certain things. It's those rather than the consumer side or the banking side.
You make it sound so underground with the the criminal and money laundering
well,
aspect.
There is an element of that.
Neela, go ahead.
That's what the Treasury is concerned at, that this person-to-person virtual transfer could actually mm-hmm. kind of help and make it easier to do money laundering and other kind of illicit activities. But right now, people, whoever they are, mm-hmm. who are interested in the Bitcoin seem to be treating it more like a tech stock, something to invest in rather than something to actually use as a medium of exchange. And so the question to me in my mind is, when does that change? When do I order pizzas with my Bitcoin
right.
as opposed to buying Bitcoins and hoping that I could be as an early adapter, like an early adapter to the internet, that this will one day pay off.
Right. Yeah, and the Bitcoin looks all too much like tulips in 1637 Holland, you know, with the tulip mania or other manias, tech stocks in the late 90s. And in technical language, a medium of exchange, a currency, something we use to buy other things with that doesn't mm-hmm. itself have a use. I mean, you can't really do much with a US bill, right? To be good, it needs to have a stable value. And that's the problem. When it hasn't had a stable, Bitcoin hasn't. It's been subject to speculation. And when with speculators, the thing about speculators are they want to make money. And when they consider that they've made all the money that they're going to make, they are as likely to sell again. And assets, if we can call it, assets are things that have gone up a lot, have tended to come down as quickly. And I think,
sure.
That is my expectation, that we've seen a lot of volatility. I mean, you're not going to, the whole point about a US dollar is, or deposits in your bank, is that you're happy to keep them there, a certain balance there, because you're reasonably sure that they're going to maintain their value.
Right.
But the Bitcoin, it's far from the case. I mean, if you're actually using it for if you're accepting it, if you're a retailer accepting the Bitcoin, unless you have a view as an investor or a speculator, you're going to want to sell out of it pretty damn quick in case the price collapses.
Sure.
So it's, in a strange kind of way, speculation. The bubble has kind of undermined the Bitcoin and what it really is there to do, which is to be a non-governmental medium of exchange. And that's a bit of a shame.
Goes right back to the title of the analysis itself, Bubble Trouble or Here to Stay. Neela.
I just wanted to ask Melissa, if you had a choice between 1,000 lottery tickets or a Bitcoin worth $1,000 for your
right.
Christmas stocking this year, which bet would you take?
Well, I would obviously take the lotto tickets. But it's an interesting topic because Congress has expressed an interest in Bitcoin. They had two hearings last month and invited some of the folks from the Justice Department and
right.
Treasury to testify. And, you know, so there's some interest in Congress perhaps passing a law on Bitcoin. But I think the general consensus out of those hearings mm-hmm. was, well, we're not quite ready yet. And we, you know, back in the 90s, we let the internet kind of take form, and then we looked towards how we can improve it, how we can protect users. And I kind of feel it looks like that's what they're going to do with Bitcoin as well. And the Federal Election Commission, they actually were asked to look into allowing Bitcoins to be used for campaign donations in the upcoming election. And they, too, have said, we're not quite ready to go there yet.
Right.
Let's hold off for now.
But you can buy a Tesla.
But you can buy a Tesla.
There you go. You can buy a Tesla.
When will I be getting my lotto ticket?
Ask Chris here at his study.
Well, thank you very much to all of you for joining us on this BGov roundtable. Of course, it's Melissa Avstray, Chris Payne, and Dr. Neela Richardson. And with that, we wrap up this week's edition of Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact. Follow us on Twitter at BGov. Follow me on Twitter at Alan L. Scott. And we'll catch you next Thursday at 11 with plenty more to say about the business impact of government actions. For BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, I'm Alan Scott.